Expected, but I'd like to tell you about some work that we did a little while ago, thinking about how to combine two kind of current themes in condensed matter that have both been pretty interesting recently, which are non-trivial physics due to strong spin-orbit coupling and the Mott transition in correlated electron systems. So I'm going to actually talk about two projects in this vein. And the first was work done with my student Gong Shen, who's actually graduating this year. He'll be at UCCU, what it's called, University of Colorado, and Andreas Schneider, who's at the Max Planck in Stuttgart. And the second half is some work done with Dima Pessin, who's a postdoc at UT Austin. So spin orbit physics for many years is a subject which I always thought was kind of a boring addition to condensed matter physics. In the standard text, Ashcroft and Merman, you hardly see it mentioned anywhere. It's pretty much an afterthought. We all know spin orbit is some weak relativistic correction to quantum mechanics, and at least for most purposes. And Ashcroft and Merman tells you it's got treated by maybe half a page of text in some middle chapter of the book, saying it sometimes splits some degeneracies in band structures. But recently, it's actually become more and more the focus of active research. Starting with the field of spintronics, where people have learned to really measure a lot of interesting non-trivial effects, like the spin Hall effect, which arise entirely due to spin orbit coupling. And most recently, very interesting kind of qualitative effects, not merely quantitative ones, have become very interesting. It's certainly one of the hot topics now. In condensed matter physics is the discovery of what people call topological insulators, and both in 2D kind of quantum well structures and in three-dimensional bulk materials, which to my mind is kind of the most exciting things. And the list of these new materials started out small, but is growing very, very rapidly. Turns out to be not such an uncommon phenomena in solids. So I'll try and tell you a little bit about that. Here's a plan. I'll give kind of a very brief introduction. This could easily be the subject of many, many talks. I'm sure if you went to the March meeting, there were many, many sessions on these interesting topological insulators. But I'll just give you a rapid overview. And then I want to talk about effects of interactions, which is kind of a largely untouched, relatively speaking, topic in this subject. I'm going to divide that into two parts. I'm going to talk about effects of strong spin-orbit interactions in materials that are very strong Mott insulators, where the charges, the electrons, are very strongly localized. And then I'm going to talk about kind of the intermediate limit, where systems are close to being in a transition between being a metal or an insulator. So first, the overview. So topological insulators. Well, this subject really has almost single-handedly initiated by the work of Charlie Kane and his collaborators, who really recognize that these things exist both in two dimensions and three dimensions. What's quite remarkable, particularly this three-dimensional effect, is really a remarkable thing to have been discovered now. It's kind of a missing piece of the band theory of solids. And I guess precisely because Ashcroft and Merman thought that spin orbit effects are only some small perturbation to solids, this is not something that really got significantly thought about. But it's something that could have been discovered in the framework of the band theory of solids maybe 50 years ago, in principle. But it wasn't. And it's quite a remarkable thing. Essentially, these topological insulators have a lot of similarity to quantum Hall systems. They're nominally band insulators, but which have a kind of deep topological structure very similar to that of the integer quantum Hall effect. And like a 2D electron gas in the integer quantum Hall regime, they actually have protected surface states, somewhat like the edge states of a 2D electron gas in the quantum Hall regime. These are, we call them helical surface states, that actually, because the surface of a 3D material is a two-dimensional surface, they actually behave like two-dimensional chiral Dirac fermions. It's interesting that such chiral Dirac fermions actually can never exist in a strictly two-dimensional system. They can only exist at the surface of a three-dimensional system. In some respects, this kind of mechanism has actually been anticipated for many years in lattice gauge theory, which struggles with the problem of modeling chiral fermions, like neutrinos, in a lattice model of QCD. One interesting consequence of this unusual chiral structure is that these fermions actually can never be localized by disorder. So it's a kind of protected metallic state. It's believed that the surface of such a topological insulator is always metallic, no matter how dirty you make it, et cetera. And also, these materials have very interesting magnetoelectric responses that in some sense are quantized. So there are several experimental materials. There's no real time for me to go into details about how this works, but just to show you a quick graphic, if you haven't seen this stuff before. Experimentally, the investigation of these materials has really been led by Zahid Hassan's group in Princeton, who discovered the first examples of this phenomena in solids and have really probed it extensively using photo emission. So in these photo emission studies of, I guess this is bismuth telluride, you can kind of explicitly see the small circular Fermi surface here associated with a surface Dirac cone. And actually here is the surface Dirac cone structure. So this is momentum and energy. So there have been a lot of recent developments in the study of these topological insulators. Experiments are moving incredibly fast. You know, you'll find probably typically one or two, maybe more preprints every day on the CONMAT server. With new developments. So experimentalists have been able to take topological insulators and by doping them in various ways, make them superconducting or make them ferromagnetic. There have been scanning tunneling microscopy measurements of the scattering of surface states, of these protected surface states at the surface, and really confirm the idea that they're protected from localization. There are also surface transport measurements that actually show directly surface conduction recently. And theory is moving even more rapidly. I mentioned there are continually new details of magnetoelectric effects have been and optical effects have been predicted. One of the more interesting exotic areas of study related to this is it turns out that by combining topological insulators with superconductors, you can actually create very interesting kind of topologically protected non-trivial quantum excitations at the interface of those structures, in particular Majorana fermions, which are of great fundamental interest and possibly for applications to quantum computing. So this is very rich. It's moving very fast. It's all very interesting, but as a theorist, one can't help but notice that one particular thing is very much absent in the theory of this work, and that's interactions. In a way, that's a strength, and it's probably a reason why this field has moved so fast, is that basically everything about topological insulators and all these related phenomena can be understood just by thinking about non-interacting electrons. That's certainly a strength because it means we can apply all the powerful machinery of band theory, which allows you actually to make concrete predictions for what material could be a topological insulator. And you can see the experimental impact in new materials rather dramatically there. And you know, theorists, of course, are pretty good at solving free electron problems. But we know interactions are important in many materials, and we'd like to understand what new phenomena might arise there. So it's not that there's been no work on related phenomena involving strong interactions. There's been a bit, but certainly much less, and not so directly connected to materials and experiments. I'll just mention a few examples that I'm aware of work prior to ours on interaction effects. One interesting line of research that theorists have pursued is the possibility that a material, a model with no intrinsic spin-orbit coupling, could nevertheless develop that spin-orbit interaction spontaneously, breaking spin-rotational symmetry in a spontaneous way, and thereby becoming a topological insulator. That's interesting, but perhaps it's not a necessary thing to explore, since there are plenty of materials with strong intrinsic spin-orbit coupling. The latter two works are things that are closer to the spirit of what I'll talk about. This is a very interesting idea that suggests studies the effect of interactions in a particular material, a sodium iridate, which is a two-dimensional, quasi-two-dimensional 5D electron system that proposed that interactions could lead to antiferromagnetism in a topological insulator. This last work here suggests a way in which a kind of fractional version of the two-dimensional topological insulator, what's called the quantum spin Hall effect, could actually occur. It's a kind of quantum spin Hall effect combined with spin charge separation. These latter two things will be somewhat related to what I talk about in the second part of the talk. All right, so we're nearing the end of the introduction. I want to try and get a little bit more specific. I want to start by kind of trying to draw a schematic phase diagram for the phenomena that I'll talk about. When we think about the electronic structure of solids and condensed matter, the simplest sort of model that we can imagine that incorporates both band structure and correlation effects is a Hubbard model. Okay, so I'd like you to imagine a Hubbard model which has, if you want, three terms in it, roughly speaking. There's there would be a kinetic energy for the electrons in this Hubbard model, which is parameterized by some kind of hopping strength, T. There would be spin-orbit interactions, parameterized by spin-orbit coupling constant, lambda. And then we'll also worry about the strength of the Coulomb repulsion, U, some Hubbard model. So that in that model, there are three, just two dimensionless parameters, the dimensionless strength of spin-orbit interactions and the dimensionless strength of the Hubbard interaction. So if you like, the existing work on topological insulators has explored this horizontal axis here where they're in the absence of correlations. I want you to have in mind, since we're going to be interested in correlation effects, we're going to be thinking of d-electron systems rather than s and p-electron systems, which have mostly been investigated so far. In a d-electron system, these are transition metals. Transition metals are aptly named because they're usually metallic. They're usually metallic because in transition metals, you have partially occupied d-levels. There are a lot of them near the Fermi energy. Typically, that leads to a lot of overlapping bands. At the band structure level, most transition metal compounds are metallic. Without correlations, we usually think of most transition metal compounds as being metallic. However, as you increase spin-orbit interaction, it's possible, under certain circumstances, the spin-orbit interactions can lift a lot of the degeneracies of these d-levels. If the occupation is just right, this will lead to a large splitting of all the bands near the Fermi energy, and actually just at the band structure level, that can lead to a band insulator. If you're careful and you find the right structure with the right symmetries and the right orbitals, it can be that this band insulator is actually a topological band insulator. So a little bit later in the talk, I'll show you a model which does this. Along this axis, we can actually tune between a metal and a topological insulator. In this talk, I'm going to use a slightly different convention than most people use when talking about these materials. I'm going to refer to what people usually call topological insulators as topological band insulators, because these are systems without any substantial correlations. The other axis is the usual one that people think about in transition metal compounds, which measures the strength of correlation. So without correlations and without spin orbit coupling, we have a metal. As we crank up the Coulomb mu, eventually we forbid double occupancy and we get an insulator for Mott reasons. So we have these two axes. We understand the behavior along each of these two axes. This is the usual Mott metal insulator transition. This is a kind of band transition between a metal and a topological band insulator. The question is what happens in between. So we'll try and fill in this picture. One point I want to make, though, which is probably the most, in some senses, the most important message from this talk, is that we need to think carefully about when spin-orbit interaction should be considered as strong. So if we have no correlations, this has a very simple answer. The only energy scale to measure spin-orbit coupling relative to is the bandwidth, so the hopping T. So strong spin-orbit interactions means that lambda is comparable to the bandwidth of the electrons. However, as we increase Coulomb correlations, what happens, of course, is the electrons become more and more localized, and kinetic energy becomes less and less important. At very large U, in fact, kinetic energy is basically totally unimportant. We have localized electrons, and they really communicate to each other not by hopping, but by exchange. So that the relevant energy scale to compare spin-orbit coupling to up here is not hopping, but exchange, which is T squared over U rather than T. So what it means is that at large U, actually, even a relatively small spin-orbit interaction is strong. So there's a line on this phase diagram, if you want, which I tried to denote by this shaded boundary, which separates a weak spin-orbit interacting regime and a strong one. And that line marches inexorably to the left as we move up. So what this means is that actually you should expect stronger and stronger spin-orbit effects in materials that are more and more correlated. Nevertheless, we can explore different regions of this phase diagram. So we can explore the very large U limit, in which the electrons are very strongly localized, or we can explore the kind of intermediate U limit, where they're not that strongly localized, but still spin orbit effects may be important. So where would we look for these things in materials? So first, let's talk about the strong Mott insulating limit. By strong Mott insulators, I mean systems where you can really regard the electrons as very localized, where there's a large gap for free electrons or holes in the system. So typically, that happens. That is more likely to happen in 3D transition metal compounds. As we know, as you move down from 3D to 4D to 5D. The d orbitals become more and more extended, and as a consequence, the Hubbard U is usually smaller in the heavier transition metal oxides. So strong Mott localization is more confined to the 3D or maybe 4D transition metals usually. On the other hand, the lighter transition metals have weaker spin orbit coupling. So often this is not such an easy situation to achieve. It does happen sometimes in iron and cobalt compounds. Those are the ones in which spin orbit effects are the largest in the 3D transition metals because they have a lot of orbital degeneracy. If you want to go to heavier transition metals, then you have to look at, to get to this regime, you need to look at materials that happen to have very narrow bands. So this will happen if, for instance, the transition metals there are very widely separated in the crystal structure. So, for instance, double perovskites are materials like this where the transition metals that sort of carry the conducting electrons are separated by other D0 transition metals or non-transition metal atoms. So these double perovskites are interesting systems from that point of view. More often, it's the case that strong Mott insulators don't really have strong spin-orbit interactions. We would say they're weak in the sense they're not large compared to exchange. In that case, you can usually think of spin-orbit coupling as something like Dialyshinsky-Maria interactions, for instance. But it's still true in many cases that those weak spin-orbit interactions actually control the physics of the material. I'm not going to so much talk about that situation here, but it actually is very important in a lot of materials. So actually, in the As I eventually get to some actual content in this talk, I will I'll tell you about this particular material up here. In some respects, the most interesting region to talk about is this intermediate correlation regime, basically where all the interactions are comparable. We'll be interested in situations where the Hubbard U is kind of comparable to the bandwidth, so the electrons are not sure whether to be localized or extended, and the spin orbit coupling is also comparable to the bandwidth. Okay. So these are what I would call weak mod insulators with strong spin orbit interactions. So weak mod insulators are with strong spin orbit are actually relatively easy to find. Because we can get strong spin orbit by going to 5D transition metals, and those systems are also tend to be rather not so good mod insulators. Actually, most 5D transition metal compounds are metallic, not mod insulating at all, because the U is too small. But you can find in quite a variety of situations that the combination of spin orbit coupling and Hubbard repulsion can make these materials insulating. So that's a very interesting situation where really spin orbit and U together are working to produce a non-trivial insulating state. And some of the most interesting materials to explore in this respect are iridium compounds, which for reasons I'll explain have a rather beneficial electronic structure for hoping to see this kind of phenomena. So I'll talk about that in the latter part of the talk. Okay, so let me first tell you about our... the work we did on this iron scandium sulfide. Okay. So I got interested in this material as part of a kind of long-standing interest in a very fundamental problem of quantum magnetism, the search for quantum spin liquids. So these are states that have been imagined at least since the 70s by Phil Anderson and others in which you have local moments, you have well-formed electronic spins, but quantum fluctuations prevent these spins from ordering even at the lowest temperatures, even in the ground state. They've been kind of a pipe dream for condensed matter theorists for decades, but the last 5 or 10 years, there have been more and more materials that have been discovered that look, at least on the surface of it, like they might actually display this interesting phenomena. And so here's a kind of a laundry list of some of the more exciting candidates in this regard. Quantitatively, they all show the property that you can cool them well below the characteristic temperature of order the exchange coupling in the material, called the Curie-Weiss temperature, and they still do not magnetically order. Now, the vast majority of these are very low spin systems, spin 1/2 or spin 1, so highly quantum spin systems, where you would... And on frustrated geometries where you would probably expect to see strong quantum effects. Iron scandium sulfide, from the point of view of being able to cool it well below its characteristic magnetic temperature, appears as good a candidate as any of these, but it's unusual because its iron spins, these are actually spin two spins, which you would expect to be very classical, and they're actually on a not obviously frustrated lattice. So it's a kind of a strange material to discover on this list. Here's just a quick show of the data. So here's a kind of standard plot that you'll see in talks on frustrated magnetism. This is a plot of the inverse susceptibility versus temperature. You can see it's very linear over this temperature range that reflects a Curie law. It's slightly displaced from the pure Curie law, which means that it has an intercept with the x-axis, which is not at zero temperature. It's at some negative temperature, which implies a negative Curie-Weiss temperature. In this case, it's actually a negative temperature. There should be a minus sign here, minus about 50 Kelvin. 45 Kelvin is the more precise estimate, which gives you an idea of the strength of magnetic interactions. However, you can actually cool this material down to 30 millikelvin and see no trace of any magnetic ordering, despite the fact that we have a system with 50 Kelvin kind of magnetic interactions with spin two spins. By contrast, here's another material with the same structure, just with iron replaced by manganese, which has a Curie-Weiss temperature about half that of iron scandium sulfide, and it actually orders at 2 Kelvin. Okay, so you can cool this down by about a factor of 10, about a factor of, 100, more and still not see any order in this material. Yeah, I'll show you. Okay. So these materials have the spinel structure, they're actually a range of materials with this structure. As Bruce asked, so the magnetic site, this is called the A site of the spinel structure. The A site forms actually a diamond lattice. Here's kind of a spectrum of materials with this structure, with various different transition metals, manganese, cobalt, iron. They're arranged on this axis in order of what's usually called the frustration parameter, the ratio of the Curie-Weiss temperature to the magnetic ordering temperature. So since iron scandium sulfide doesn't actually order, we don't actually know what F is. Well, we know that it's bigger than 1,000. On the other hand, every other material studied shows a frustration parameter of less than 20. Okay. So there's something special about this material, and what it actually is is reflected in the, it's a reflection of the very different electronic state of the iron in this material. So we're going to focus on this particular case because it's so unusual and interesting, and it'll turn out that spin orbit plays a crucial role. In this material, the iron has 6d electrons, maybe I could just show you on the next slide. Okay. So iron 2 plus in this material has 6d electrons. The iron is in a site of tetrahedral coordination. Under that oxygen or scandium coordination, the 5d levels split in this way into an upper triplet and a lower doublet. And just filling these levels according to Hund's rules, what you find is that every level is occupied by at least one electron, but you have some choice. You end up with one hole in this lower doublet called an E doublet, and you can choose whether to have the hole in the first or the second level of this doublet. Hund's rules tells you that the unpaired spin should align. That leads you to a spin 2, which we could describe by some spin 2 quantum spin operator. But in addition, there's this twofold degeneracy, so there's kind of a two-level system, or if you like, a pseudo-spin, which we could describe by some Pauli matrix. So this is a lot of degeneracy. If you actually count the states here, we have 2s plus 1 states for the spin, that's 5, and 2 states for the two-level system, so there's a total degeneracy of 10. So if we integrate the specific heat from low temperature up to high temperature, we should be able to see this entropy of R log 10 for every site. And indeed, one can see that, so that the red curve here is for iron scandium sulfide, and you can easily see that it passes right through the spin-only entropy, R log 5, and approaches at temperatures larger than the Curie-Weiss temperature, the total expected entropy of R log 10 here. Okay. So this is kind of a direct indication that the spin, the electron here has accessible to it these 10 states. So it's an interesting system in which the electron has a lot of degeneracy. It has both the spin degeneracy and the orbital degeneracy. When we have spin and orbit, you might expect that spin-orbit coupling would be important, just linguistically. Indeed, that's the case, although it's a little bit more subtle than you might think. So it turns out that symmetry allows just one form of coupling of this pseudo-spin orbital operator, tau, to the spin operator, S, and it looks like this. This would be probably familiar to someone who knows something about the structure of EG orbitals, which are the D orbitals in cubic crystal fields. One thing you'll notice, though, is that this is quadratic in the spin operators. So this is not the bare spin-orbit coupling, which, of course, is like lambda L dot S. This is some effective spin-orbit interaction, which is second order in the bare spin-orbit coupling. And actually, you can derive this from the microscopic atomic picture. This turns out to be proportional to the bare spin-orbit coupling, lambda 0 squared divided by the energy gap between these, the doublet and the triplet levels there. Okay. So this is something that's present at the single atom level. And so you can try and just solve this quantum mechanics problem on the single atom. So there are 10 states, so there's a 10 by 10 matrix, which you have to diagonalize, in which you have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. It's not difficult to do. you solve this problem, you find that you get the 10 levels split into this structure with a non-degenerate ground state, a triplet, and another singlet up there. So the important thing to note here is that we started out with 10 degenerate levels, but in the presence of lambda, actually, we end up with a non-degenerate ground state, a singlet, if you like. Okay. And that singlet, at the single atomic level, would have a gap to the first excited state, this triplet, equal to lambda. If we make a simple-minded estimate of this for iron 2 plus, we'll end up with an energy scale of about 25 Kelvin. Okay. That's part of it, yeah. There's no need for a Jahn-Teller distortion because we split the degeneracy anyway by spin-orbit interaction. You will see that the story is a little more subtle than this. But so what is a stay? I said it's a singlet, but it's not a spin singlet. This is a singlet that arises from spin-orbit coupling. So this is it's a singlet in the sense of a single level, but it's certainly not a spin-zero state. It's actually a entangled state of spin and orbital degrees of freedom, which you could write something like this. So there's it's a superposition of a state with SC equals zero and some other states with larger values of SC in different orbital states. Okay. Nevertheless, it's a unique state, and there's a gap. Whenever you have an energy gap to all excitations, we know that this is going to be a very stable phase. If we have small interactions perturbing the spin orbit, we would expect this would be a very simple ground state. So this might already explain the absence of magnetic ordering in iron scandium sulfide. But fortunately, or interestingly, it turns out that life is not that simple. So this is a completely atomic explanation for why you could have a non-magnetic ground state in this material. If this were reality, there's actually no exchange of electrons from atom to atom in this picture. So the excitations would not disperse at all in this simple atomic model. In fact, here's low-temperature inelastic neutron scattering data on iron scandium sulfide. You very clearly see a strongly dispersing magnetic feature here with a dispersion which is tens of Kelvin. So this scale is millivolts. So one can see there's some kind of a band with a bandwidth of 20, 30, 40 millikelvin here. And that should make you worried about the simple-minded spin-orbit coupling picture. First of all, because the bandwidth that you see here is actually comparable to the spin-orbit interaction. I said that that's about 25 Kelvin. So it's clear that you cannot neglect processes in which the electron can actually communicate with its neighbors by some exchange. The second thing that you notice, if you look carefully here, is that this dispersing feature does not touch down at zero, but it comes awfully close. Actually, if you look directly at the line scans of this inelastic neutron data, you'll see that there's actually an energy gap here, but it's very small. It's an energy gap of only one or two Kelvin. And that's interesting because somehow the system is developing a very small energy gap that's about 10 or 20 times smaller than both the magnetic bandwidth and the spin-orbit interactions. And you can also see that energy gap in NMR measurements. Here's a 1 over T1, the red curve here is for iron scandium sulfide, 1 over T1 relaxation rate of iron scandium sulfide. You see it dives down here at low temperatures. If you fit this to an activation law, you get an activation energy of about 2 Kelvin. Okay. So somehow the system develops a very small energy gap, much smaller than the energy gap that we would have expected of 25 Kelvin just from spin-orbit interactions. So it's pretty clear why things are not as we expect. The reason is that there is exchange, and this is somehow competing with spin-orbit coupling. So what do we do about exchange? Well, we need to try and model it somehow. The first thing, as a theorist, we typically try to do is appeal to symmetry. In this case, symmetry doesn't get us very far. So for any pair of sites on the in this spinel structure, a pair of A sites, there are actually five symmetry-allowed couplings between spins and orbitals. Now, it turns out in the spinel structure, because the A sites are so far apart, that exchange between second neighbors is often comparable or even larger than the exchange between first neighbors. So we need to worry about exchange, these terms, both on nearest neighbor sites and second neighbor sites. So symmetry alone will tell us that we can determine the form of the exchange interactions, but with 10 undetermined parameters. And as everyone knows, we can fit an elephant with 10 undetermined parameters. certainly we can fit this amount of experimental data. So we need a little bit more constraints. We have to think a little bit more microscopically. And it turns out, at least we can find a good point to start with some very simple arguments. So if you think about where exchange interactions come from, where they come from is actually just a virtual hopping. You take one electron from an orbital in one atom, and you hop it via some intermediate sites to another one of these iron sites to briefly doubly occupy one of these levels and then bring it back. Okay. Well, we can, since we have all these unpaired electrons, we can do this by hopping an electron from this orbital, or from this orbital, or from this orbital, or from this degenerate pair of orbitals down here. So the thing to notice is that if we exchange any of these non-degenerate orbitals, no information is communicated on the orbital state of this degenerate doublet down here. And there are many more processes that exchange these upper orbitals than exchange the lower one. So these upper processes, they do contribute to exchange, but just to orbitally independent exchange. They just contribute to the usual Heisenberg S dot S interaction. So from this kind of reasoning, we expect that this Heisenberg interaction is much stronger than the other exchange interactions in this material. That already reduces our uncertainty a lot. We figure that a reasonable starting point is just to include only the usual Heisenberg interactions. Now, we should include that between both first and second neighbor sites, so we still are left with a little bit of uncertainty. To resolve that, we can appeal to experiment. Here's that inelastic neutron data again. We saw this strongly dispersing magnetic excitation. The important thing we notice is that it has a very pronounced minimum at the point where this gap is at a very sharply defined wave vector. And so the magnitude of that wave vector gives us a lot of information about what the dominant exchange is. It turns out that this is actually the natural ordering wave vector that we would expect if the system had a dominant second neighbor exchange rather than first neighbor exchange. So based on this, we postulate that the first neighbor exchange is very weak, and we just study this model. Okay. So now we have really only one undetermined parameter, which is the ratio of this exchange strength to the spin orbit coupling. Okay. We know that those should be comparable. That's the range that we're interested in. Okay. So this is a simple model. We can study it by one of the simplest approximations in theoretical physics, the mean field approximation. So just replace the spin by its expectation value and make this self-consistent, like you learn in your undergraduate class on StatMech. Okay. This is easy to work out. If you work this out, you end up with a very simple phase diagram that looks like this, actually. So on the horizontal axis is the ratio of spin orbit strength to exchange. Here is temperature. It does kind of what you expect. If spin orbit is very weak, then the exchange is going to produce a magnetic ground state. We actually get an antiferromagnet, which is ordered along 1-0. On the other hand, if spin orbit is large, we get this large gap. We get a singlet ground state, which is non-magnetic. As you decrease lambda, at some point the gap closes, and that's a quantum critical point, which leads to this magnetically ordered phase. As you approach here, the gap of the singlet state decreases and decreases and decreases and comes to zero. So it's very natural to interpret the experiments on iron scandium sulfide as just saying that it lies very close to this quantum critical point at a point where the gap is very small, the magnon excitation is very strongly dispersing, and it's almost magnetically ordered. And actually, if you try and actually estimate J2, which you can do from that inelastic neutron data, and lambda, which we have a microscopic estimate for, we end up very close to this value. So it's a very simple theory. It predicts a lot of things that are also in accord with experiment. And because the spin orbit coupling is very strong, you get a very large zero temperature susceptibility. There's a small gap, which is indeed what's seen in these NMR experiments. Theory would actually predict a T cube magnetic specific heat. One actually observes something like 2 to the 2.5 in fits, so we think that's pretty reasonable. What we'd really like to see, and this is a prediction rather than a comparison with experiment, is that if the system is actually close to this quantum critical point, it should be hopefully possible to push it across the quantum critical point in some way, and we hope that that might be accomplished by applying pressure. So, experimentalists are trying to look at that, but I haven't heard any results so far. Okay, I think I'm going to move on. So I'd like to move on to the latter part of the talk, but just emphasize the conclusions here, which to me are kind of surprising. You know, the combination of orbital degeneracy and spin orbit coupling in a very strong mod insulator can actually lead to a non-magnetic state and some simple but interesting example of a quantum critical point. And to me, it's kind of an amazing thing that this is still a very quantum state, even though it has something to do with very simple single-site physics. We know the ground state here is some strongly entangled state of spin and orbital degrees of freedom. And it's an entirely quantum ground state, which is not at all what you expect in a spin 2 system. It, definitely the prevailing thought in that is that any spin 2 magnet is very, very classical. And so the combination of spin orbit coupling and orbital degeneracy can make totally invalidate that. Okay. So now I want to move to this second topic of the Mott transition with spin-orbit interactions. So this is going to be somewhat more speculative than the first part. So to try and ground it a little bit, I'm going to phrase this problem in a more concrete example. So actually, we got interested in this because we're thinking about some specific materials, in particular iridium pyrochlores, which are very interesting compounds for various reasons. So this is the pyrochlore crystal structure. It looks horrible. From our point of view, it's sufficient to just study the iridium sublattice here. So we're going to be looking at materials where the d electrons live on just on this iridium site. These are the conducting electrons. The iridium sites form this famous pyrochlore lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra. So in case you don't know, the pyrochlore structure is a cubic structure. It's a simple FCC Bravais lattice. And for our purposes, we can really study just those iridium atoms. So one of the appealing features of this class of materials is it's rather tunable. So you can tune it by varying the rare earth atom on the A site, which has, as the ionic radius of the rare earth varies, one manipulates the bandwidth of the d electrons. And basically, the reason this happens is that as you vary the ionic radius, the bandwidth, which is controlled by hopping through an intervening oxygen atom, changes because the iridium-oxygen-iridium angle changes. So when this angle is close to 180 degrees, that's sort of the optimal direction for electron hopping, because the p orbital is perfectly aligned, the oxygen is perfectly aligned with the path between the two iridiums. As you vary that angle, the bandwidth gets lower and lower and lower. And typically, the Mott transition in a material happens when the bandwidth becomes comparable to some measure of the interaction strength, like the Hubbard U. So what you see in these materials is actually they display a finite temperature metal insulator transition. And the temperature of this transition drops precipitously as we increase the ionic radius, getting very small for neodymium and actually vanishing for praseodymium. So this material is actually metallic at all temperatures. The other materials are insulating at low temperature. The other appealing feature of this class of materials is that they use iridium, which for one thing is a rather heavy transition metal oxide, one of the heaviest, and it has a rather large intrinsic spin-orbit coupling of about half an electron volt, which you can compare to the lambda that we talked about in iron scandium sulfide was 25 Kelvin, okay, drastically larger. So what we did was start by trying to come up with a model. Remember, I showed you the schematic phase diagram of a Hubbard model. We try and make this more specific for thinking about these materials. So rather than write down the model, which is actually quite ugly, I'll just tell you its ingredients. So we have to start by figuring out what states to include. So iridium is in the 4-plus oxidation state, so it has 5 d electrons. There's a large splitting in this ion between the higher energy doublet and the lower energy triplet. So all these 5 d electrons lie in the lower energy triplet. However, that leaves one hole. And this hole could live in any one of these 3 orbitals. Okay. So we're going to include just these 3 T2G orbitals, and the five occupied electrons, or one hole. So if you want to think about the degrees of freedom on a site, if a site has an electron on it, then that electron has a threefold orbital degeneracy, or the hole has a threefold orbital degeneracy, and there's also a twofold spin degeneracy. Spin one-half and orbital angular momentum one. Now we have to allow for this electron to hop from one iridium to the other, so it needs to hop if it wants to be metallic. So how does that happen? Well, we saw experimentally that that the bandwidth is very strongly tuned by this bond angle. So we believe that most of the hopping occurs via the intervening oxygen site. So the way this works is that if you have an iridium on a d orbital like this one, the T2g orbitals are orbitals like xy, yz, xz. This orbital overlaps just with this particular oxygen orbital, the one which is perfectly aligned with it. So this is, let's say this is the x and the y axis is the xy orbital, and this is the py orbital. Okay. So we assume that we only have hopping through this intervening oxygen, then everything else is geometry. So there's one parameter, that's our hopping t, determined by this. The second parameter, we need the spin orbit coupling. This is very simple because we just have to include the orbital angular momentum L and couple it to S. Okay. And finally, we have the Hubbard interaction U. So when U is zero, of course, now we have just a type binding model. We can try and solve it. It's a little bit complicated. You should count the states. So that on every iridium site, we have three orbitals, and we have two spin states. Okay, let's forget spin for the moment. We have three orbitals. And in the pyrochlore lattice, everything is built up of this elementary unit of a tetrahedron. So there are four such atoms. So 3 times 4 is 12. We're going to have actually 12 bands in this calculation. So some 12 by 12 matrix needs to be diagonalized. Each band is doubly degenerate because of the two spin states, and that remains degenerate even with spin orbit coupling because the material has inversion symmetry. Okay. And what one finds is something like this. So as usually the case in a transition metal, if we have weak spin orbit coupling, these bands very strongly overlap at the Fermi energy, and we end up with a metal. Actually, there are four different bands which overlap the Fermi energy at very small lambda and give some complicated Fermi surfaces. However, as we increase the spin orbit coupling, eventually these bands all separate, and you end up with a gap at the Fermi energy. Now, the reason for the separation, part of it is kind of simple to understand, and it comes back to this picture. Remember that we have a threefold orbital degeneracy. Even though these are d-electron states, from the point of view of the orbital angular momentum operator, it turns out that threefold degeneracy behaves just like an L equals 1 orbital angular momentum, these were p orbitals rather than d orbitals. Okay. So this is just a fact. It turns out that if you project the orbital angular momentum operator into the space of the three T2g orbitals, you get something proportional to the L equals 1 orbital angular momentum operator. So we have, it's as though we have orbital angular momentum 1 and spin angular momentum 1/2. The rules of angular momentum addition tells you can add these to get L plus S or L minus S, either J equals 1/2 or J equals 3/2. It turns out that when you do that, the higher energy state, which is where the hole will live, is in the J equals 1/2 state. So when lambda is very large, and if we could neglect hopping entirely, what we'd find is that the J states would split into J equals 3/2 and J equals 1/2, and the Fermi level would be in the J equals 1/2 states. So we know already from just this atomic reasoning that all the bands associated with the J equals 1/2 states will be pushed far away from the Fermi energy by lambda. So what that means is that when lambda is sufficiently large, which actually happens before it's this big, even for lambda around 1, these J equals 3/2 bands are pushed way out of the picture, you end up with only the bands associated with the J equals 1/2 states, and there are only 4 of those rather than 12 near the Fermi energy. And as you crank up lambda a little further, these 4 bands split into 2 pairs with a gap between them looking like this. Okay. So this is some kind of band insulator. It turns out that this is actually a topological band insulator. Happily, there's been some very nice theoretical work by Liang Fu and Charlie Kane, which tell us how, for a for a model like this, once we've computed the band structure, to very simply determine whether it's a topological band insulator or not. So there's certain parity eigenvalues that you can compute, which immediately tells you that this is what's known as a strong topological band insulator. Now, one can directly see the consequence of this by just studying the band structure in the presence of a surface. What you find, I don't know if you can see this very well, is that in the presence of a surface, you get a whole bunch of continuum states, which are the bulk states. But in addition, you get these levels here inside the bulk band gap, which are actually surface states. And they come here and they touch at this special boundary, special inversion symmetric point in the Brillouin zone. This touching point is actually the location of a surface Dirac point. I said that these systems have support chiral fermions at the surface, and this is actually that chiral fermion. So what have we done? Well, we've actually filled in the bottom axis of this phase diagram. So what we see is that there's a transition between the metal and a topological band insulator here. So the next thing we can try and do is fill in the very large U part of this phase diagram. So that, again, is sort of simple. So at large U, we know that the electrons are localized. We can adopt some kind of effective spin model. Forget about hopping. We don't have to worry about band structure anymore. And as usual, if U is very large, we should replace hopping by its effect, which is just exchange coupling J. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, this J will be much smaller than hopping. It'll be of order T squared over U rather than T. So we expect that even for relatively moderate lambda, in this large U limit, lambda will be much bigger than exchange. So it's a reasonable approximation to just take spin orbit coupling as being large in this limit. So then things are simple. Not only do we neglect electron hopping, we just consider localized spins. In addition, we can focus only on the spin state that's at the Fermi energy, which I told you was this J equals a half state. So one ends up with just a spin one half Heisenberg model. I've used operators S here. These, you should remember, these are really total angular momentum spins. So symmetry actually constrains the Hamiltonian to have this simple form. There are only three allowed couplings. You can have an exchange J, a Dialyshinsky-Marie interaction, and some symmetric exchange anisotropy. If you actually calculate these things for our model, you find this symmetric anisotropy is very small, basically negligible, but this Dialyshinsky-Marie interaction is not. It's huge. It's 60% of the microscopic exchange. That shouldn't be too surprising since these are J states, not S states. Now, this is a Heisenberg model on the pyrochlore lattice. Aficionados of frustrated magnetism know this is one of the most frustrated problems in magnetism. You wouldn't expect it to magnetically order. However, the Dialyshinsky-Marie interactions basically totally obliterate that frustration and are well known to give order in such models. And such a huge DM interaction certainly leads to a magnetically ordered ground state. Filling this in, we know that at the top of this phase diagram, we expect a magnetically ordered state. Now the hard question, what happens at intermediate U? So the reality is we don't have a controlled approach to answer this question. Okay. So the best we can do is to try and adopt some physically reasonable approximation, which will give us some insight into what may happen. So we chose to use what's known as a slave rotor approximation that was developed some years ago for the study of Hubbard models. It's a kind of slave particle approach in which the electron is decomposed into what's called a rotor, which carries a charge, and an additional fermion, which carries the other quantum numbers like spin and orbital. And then some kind of mean field approximation is used to decouple this thing. So what are the benefits of this? Well, one benefit is it's relatively straightforward to solve this thing self-consistently. That's convenient to us as theorists. But probably more importantly, we know from extensive numerical studies of frustrated Hubbard models without spin orbit coupling that this gives qualitatively reasonable answers in those cases. Okay. So it agrees very well with a variety of more quantitative approaches on these other stuttered Hubbard models, especially the triangular lattice, which has been studied quite a bit. We know also what it doesn't describe. One thing it definitely does not describe is nesting or spin density wave physics. So anytime we have a Fermi surface which exhibits a high degree of nesting in the metallic state, we should worry that this approximation is going to be very bad. Okay. However, because of the very complicated nature of the hopping in this multi-orbital system, we find no indications that nesting should be in any way important here. So if you work out this approximation, this is the result that you get. We can fill in this phase diagram. It looks something like this. Let me point out a few features of this phase diagram. So the first one I want you to notice is this line, the boundary between the metal and the topological band insulator. It curves sharply to the left as we increase interactions. Okay. Now, this is just a reflection of this very basic qualitative point that I mentioned before, that as you increase interactions, the bandwidth, the kinetic energy of the electrons becomes suppressed, and as a consequence, spin-orbit interactions are relatively enhanced compared to that. So this boundary curves to the left because the effective bandwidth of the electrons is reduced with increasing interactions. And in fact, there's a line on this phase diagram, which is basically this line up here, which sort of defines the regime between weak spin-orbit interactions and strong spin-orbit interactions. Now, there's another line, which is this line here that crosses that one. Okay, goes through this point and comes up. This is the line that delineates the difference between, if you like, band-like electrons and mod-insulating electrons. So in this approximation, this is the line at which these rotors, these charge degrees of freedom, go from being condensed in the bottom, describing kind of Fermi liquid-like states, from being gapped, describing Mott-like states above. And we find two types of Mott insulators, depending on whether you have weak spin orbit or strong spin orbit. In the weak spin orbit regime, this narrow range up here, it's what we call a gapless Mott insulator. This is a very exotic state. This is what's known as a spin-on Fermi surface state that have been proposed in certain correlated materials. Up here, the biggest state dominating this phase diagram is what we call the topological Mott insulator. Now you see the reason for introducing the B in topological band insulator. So this is a state which is sort of a combination of a Mott insulator and a topological band insulator. It's a state in which these kind of slave fermions, call them spin-ons if you want, are in this topological insulator state. So it's actually an extremely exotic state of matter. Within this theory, this state is actually, it is both a spin-liquid state and a topological insulator. So it exhibits all kinds of exotic phenomena, like a gapless photon. It has spin-charge separation, but it also has protected chiral Dirac surface states. There's one more piece to this phase diagram that probably should be included here. Everything I've said so far was in the context of a Hubbard model, just containing strong local interactions between electrons. But of course, real electrons have Coulomb interactions, and this can lead to some qualitative effects. It turns out that on the boundary here between the metal and the topological band insulator, this is kind of a band crossing transition at which there's an electron pocket and a hole pocket in the metallic state, and these just pass by one another as you vary lambda over T. So near that transition, you have very low energy electron hole excitations. And since electrons and holes attract, they would tend to form excitons in the presence of long-range Coulomb interactions. And that physics is missing in the Hubbard model. So if you include that physics back in, we should expect some intermediate state here involving these some kind of bound electron hole pairs. An experience with such states from very old pioneering work by Halperin and Rice would lead us to suspect that this should be a magnetic state. So in the 0 minutes remaining to me, I will come back and say a couple words about experiment. To be honest, I would say that it's not clear that this theory necessarily is in particularly good agreement with experiment on these materials. I'd like to view it more as inspirational. But let me tell you a little bit about the experiments, which are in any case interesting. So here's some resistivity data on these materials. One very interesting feature here is you can see quite clearly the metal insulator transitions. they're not abrupt. There's no hysteresis in this resistivity, and the resistivity doesn't jump. From this and from thermodynamic measurements, it's believed that the metal insulator transition here is actually continuous. Okay. However, it's also magnetic. As you pass through this metal insulator transition, one sees a difference. One sees a small amount of spontaneous magnetization developing, and it's really incredibly small, particularly in the materials that are very close to the Mott transition. So you can see here, the spontaneous magnetization is in the hundredths of Bohr magneton. One has to be a little careful in discussing the spontaneous magnetization because there are rare earth moments in the system which could contribute to it. So probably the best system to look at here is the europium iridate, which actually has no rare earth magnetism. So there seems to be magnetism associated with the iridiums in these materials as well. So coming back to this phase diagram, we can sort of ask, how could we be moving through this phase space? Well, what presumably is varying in the materials as we vary the rare earth is the bandwidth. So it should affect both axes here. We're varying T. So we should be expecting to be moving in sort of a diagonal line on this diagram. If you believe the diagram, obviously the natural boundary to cross through is this one. So neglecting Coulomb effects, we should be seeing a transition from metal to a topological band insulator. That's clearly not happening in the experiment, at least as far as we can see. So a topological band insulator is a non-magnetic state. It's possible that this intermediate phase here is what's being seen in an experiment, but I'm not sure I want to make that claim. We need more experiments to actually figure out what's going on there. So let me conclude. I think I've taken all my time and just let you read and ask a couple questions if the chairman will allow me. Thanks.